Welcome to the ASHP Official Podcast, your guide to issues related to medication use, public health, and the profession of pharmacy.
All right, thank you for joining us for this episode of Clinical Conversations from ASHP Official. This podcast includes discussions about therapeutics, best practices, emerging therapies, case studies, and other topics that the clinical pharmacist will find important in practice. My name is Paris Smith, and I am an ambulatory care clinical pharmacist at Parkview Health in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I will be your host for today. This episode is the first in a two-part series on GLP-1 agonists. With me are Sarah Lostbike, who is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Colorado Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences, as well as Megan Adelman, who is a clinical pharmacy specialist at Cleveland Clinic in Akron General in Akron, Ohio. So this has really been a hot topic in recent years with increased use of GLP-1s, as well as new medications on the horizon. So today we are primed and ready to help you navigate through some clinical highlights. So let's get started, guys.
Thanks for having me, Paris. I'm super excited to be here.
Yes, thank you, Paris. We'll jump right into the first question. The first glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor, or GLP-1 agonist, exenatide, was first FDA approved in 2005 for the treatment of diabetes. Since this time, we have seen this class explode, with multiple options, indications, and dosing. However, it's really only been in the past few years that we have seen such a major increase in prescribing. Paris, can you provide us with some insight into the long-term studies we have and implications for chronic use?
Of course, that's a really great question. I think it's something that has been coming up a lot lately, just especially as we focus more on obesity management. I think, as we all know, type 2 diabetes is a chronic disease state, but I think we've been getting more into the conversation about obesity as a chronic disease state and not just a one acute disease state as well. So as we have now, the GLP-1s, like we have exenatide, semaglutide, dulaglutide, and the new GIP GLP-1 tirzepatide. But many of the long-term studies that we have available are mainly focused on the micro and macrovascular outcomes, so such as, you know, cardiovascular benefits, MACE outcomes, and chronic kidney disease. I did look into some trials that were available that did at least a five-year duration of study. Like I said, most of them are focused on those outcomes and, you know, those gastrointestinal adverse effects. But, and we all know that we use them mostly just for the cardiovascular benefit. But one thing I really want to think about is, especially when we're using GLP-1s for obesity, is there a ceiling effect to that weight loss that we see for these patients? Are we going to be using them indefinitely because obesity is a chronic disease state? But what impact does that have also on the pancreas? We know that GLP-1s do have an increased risk of pancreatitis, but is there another effect on the actual working on the pancreas similar to sulfonylureas? Is there a ceiling effect there as well? And then I know we've also been seeing a lot in the media as well about new case reports of hair loss and suicidal risk. And I think that's definitely interesting to see and study to see what, besides the weight loss and the MACE outcomes and the gastrointestinal effects, what other things will we see long term? Unfortunately, we just don't have that data yet. I'm hoping down the line, as we continue to use these medications more and more throughout the next few years, that we will start seeing those studies really focusing on other effects of long-term GLP-1 use more than just the ones we commonly use them for.
What some great points, Paris, that you bring up. Sarah, I want to loop you into to the next question. In the last couple of weeks alone, I've gotten questions left and right from my providers, as well as I'm getting requests from my nursing staff for patients that I see about the drug shortages. So Paris highlighted that these are frequently being utilized, but then the question becomes, what do we do if patients can't get them? Sarah, can you comment? What do you do in your practice?
Absolutely. Thanks, Megan. The GLP-1 agonist shortage. And when we talk about that, you know, I'm also including the GIP GLP-1 receptor agonist tirzepatide as well. has really been challenging for patients, providers, and pharmacies. And unfortunately, there isn't a simple fix. I found that my approach really differs from patient to patient depending on each situation. For context, I practice in family medicine and I primarily manage patients who have diabetes. So that's where a lot of my experience lies. I think to start, you know, the first easy option that everyone thinks of is, well, the patient can change pharmacies if you know of a pharmacy that has the medication. It can be very time consuming to call around to different pharmacies. And I will say, like, I rarely do that. But sometimes I get a patient who's really motivated and is willing to do that legwork. So that can be an option. In most cases, with the national shortages, changing pharmacies isn't really going to solve the problem. So one of the first things I look at is the dose. So often you're seeing drug shortages for certain doses. For example, dulaglutide is currently the 1.5 milligram is on shortage in my area, at least, but we are able to get the 0.75, 3, and 4.5 milligram doses. So depending on the patient, their glucose control, especially, you know, if using it for diabetes and how long they've been on their current dose, it might be appropriate to move the patient up to the next dose. Or on the flip side, if you are attempting to increase the dose, but that next dose isn't available, sometimes continuing the lower dose, if you're able to make adjustments to other medications, might be reasonable. The FDA website does have some information on the expected duration of the shortage. Obviously, it's hard to predict, but I do take that into consideration when I'm coming up with a plan for a patient. So to me, it matters if you're looking at a month, another month or so of the shortage versus multiple months. So important to take that into consideration. For other patients, converting to a different GLP-1 agonist might be a better option. Although at times, you know, we're seeing multiple agents on shortage, and we also have, you know, the issue of insurance formularies. So even that is not always as simple as it seems like it should be. There was a special report published by the American Diabetes Association last summer, so in the summer of 2023, that has some guidance on comparative dosing for diabetes and some drug shortage management tips. Overall, we really have limited data on comparative doses for weight management. And I feel like I've seen a wide range of approaches. When switching patients, I generally consider factors like glycemic control, obviously important for diabetic patients, how long the patient's been on the medication, how they tolerated it when they started, and if they've increased the doses. But ultimately, really, the cross-tolerability isn't well established. So even when switching to a comparative dose, it should be a risk-benefit discussion, and we should really be educating patients on the potential for those GI side effects. When necessary, I do generally err on the side of starting lower to improve tolerability, knowing that hopefully we can titrate up. Another issue that we've kind of seen with drug shortages is patients missing multiple doses of medications. So most of the time, the manufacturers have recommendations in the drug labeling for a single missed dose. The special report that I mentioned before from the American Diabetes Association does provide some additional guidance on, you know, depending on what drug, what dose, and how many doses the patient has missed on, like, when to retitrate or what to retitrate starting at. Generally, things that I think about are, you know, what agent are they on? What was the half-life of the drug? How long have they been on it? And again, that tolerability piece. So how have they tolerated it when they started it initially and then with dose increases? But it, again, becomes a very patient-specific decision. The last topic that I wanted to mention related to drug shortages is the compounding pharmacies offering the GLPs. I think the semaglutide is the one I hear the most about. I have gotten, you know, some questions from patients and providers on whether or not they should recommend the compounding pharmacies. I do want to start by saying, you know, there are many legitimate compounding pharmacies out there, but I think the GLPs have provided some unique issues that are important to consider when we're caring for our patients. So to start, you know, we know the FDA allows compounding pharmacies to make products that are commercially available when they're in shortage. The biggest question for me is, where are the ingredients coming from? So GLP-1s are really only available brand name at this time. So they're being manufactured by a single company. Novo Nordisk is the company that makes semaglutide, and they have said that they're not selling them in bulk for compounding. So the compounding sites are likely using salt forms of semaglutide, including semaglutide sodium and semaglutide acetate. And those salt forms are different active ingredients than what's being used in approved drugs, which contain the base form of semaglutide. So with that, we really have no data on safety or efficacy for those salt forms, and we don't know if compounding sites are doing quality or stability testing on their products. So it's important to keep in mind that the FDA doesn't review compounded versions of these drugs for safety, efficacy, or quality. The other thing that I've heard is errors related to the administration. So the compounded semaglutide medications don't come in a pen like the commercially available products. They're dispensed in a vial with a syringe, much like, you know, insulin vials and syringes. The syringes with insulin, though, are in units. So I've heard of issues or errors related to conversion between milligrams, milliliters, and units for administration, which can result in the patient getting too much or too little of the drug. And lastly, I'll just end by saying, you know, the FDA did issue that warning that they have received reports that patients have had adverse events related to using compounded semaglutide products, and they do recommend patients use FDA-approved drugs if available.
Those are some really great points, Sarah, especially about the compounding, because we want to make sure that our patients are getting safe and effective medications, but also just making sure that our compounding pharmacies are also following the state laws, as they can be different from state to state. So just making sure that everybody is working at a safe level for not only for their actual pharmacies, but also for our patients themselves. So those are some great points to add. I do also want to add as well, ASHP does also have a great resource in drug shortages as well. And they're usually very good about keeping that up to date as well for all drugs that are currently on shortages or back orders. So there's also a great resource as well as the FDA that Sarah mentioned as well.
I agree. Paris, if I can just chime in too, I think Sarah just unpacked a lot of information that it really, we probably could talk an hour or 2 hours on. And I think that Sarah also highlighted a lot of good references that we can include in the summary portion of this podcast, including not only Paris highlighted the ASHP, Sarah highlighted the FDA, as well as the guidance statement from the ADA. I think it was really helpful, and I usually tell my residents to go there. The other thing that I do want to highlight briefly is that while the guidance statement is incredibly helpful, it really sometimes doesn't allude to even tirzepatide. So the package insert, when we think about tirzepatide, it basically says that you start at the base and then just up titrate. And when we talk and collaborate with the manufacturers, at least at my site, they really say this is where clinical judgment comes into place. So I don't know if you guys have done this, but you know, if I have somebody that is not treatment naive, maybe they are on something like a duaglutide, a semaglutide. I know that the tirzepatide is more potent, but I may not start them at the 2.5 because I know they tolerate it. So I've had instances where I do use my clinical experience to say, okay, it is appropriate to start at the 5, but this is the great part about being a clinical pharmacist that you can really go based off of experience for that. But I appreciate Sarah and Paris, you sharing your content. And again, we'll include those references in the attachment portion of this podcast.
And Megan, you make a definitely excellent point. I think with the guidance, we definitely should be using our clinical judgment. I sometimes get samples in my office, which are a godsend. And so I may have a tirzepatide 2.5 that I can give to them in office, get them started, and then also send a prescription for the 5 so that they have on hand. But kind of balancing those different dosing, as we know, tirzepatide is a little bit more potent, but just having that conversation with the patient as well can definitely help as we are navigating this time in pharmacy and diabetes and obesity with these different shortages as well. But those are some other things that as well come with GLP-1 agonists. And I mentioned earlier, we've seen different case reports for like suicidal risk as well as hair loss. But one of the other interesting case reports that came out last year as well was about vomiting and aspiration of food that led to anesthesiologists actually changing their guidelines recently to address perioperative management of GLP-1 agonists as well. So Megan, can you provide us an update on this?
Yeah, thanks for that lead in, Paris. I agree that this was a statement put out by the American Association of Anesthesiologists in November of 2023. And I really don't think it got highlighted well enough because this was quite a concern in terms of seeing increased risk of aspiration pneumonia and is something from really any practice setting, if we're thinking about perioperative care, to be considering, you know, automatically my head goes to our anticoags, our antiplatelets, but this really needs to fall under the purview of any perioperative plan as well. The guidance statement notes that anybody that is taking weekly GLP-1s, that we would want to hold that agent for a week prior. And again, that's due to the pharmacokinetics, the washout period associated with that. And then for individuals doing the daily dosing, so something like liraglutide, that you would do it on the day of the procedure, holding that morning. This is, again, I've gotten some questions, well, what if I take it in the evening? This is where clinical judgment comes into place. I do anything 24 hours in advance holding. So if you take it in the morning, hold the day of the procedure. If you take it in the evening, just you skip the day, the evening before the procedure dose. The experts from this consensus guideline also note that this is irrespective of any indication, type 2 diabetes or weight loss, as well as regardless of the procedure or the surgery that's happening. Again, we're trying to prevent that aspiration pneumonia risk. So it's a great teaching point, especially if you're on a medical team that may not be aware of this update.
Yeah, definitely gotten questions from my providers sending me messages like, hey, they have a colonoscopy. How long do we need to hold? So I have to look to see, you know, what day do you take your once weekly medication, and then try to backdate from there. Because if their procedure is on a Tuesday and they normally take their once weekly on a Sunday, that technically will have to hold, not even just the Sunday, maybe the Sunday before, just to make sure that they don't have any complications during their procedure. But thank you, Megan and Sarah, for joining us today for our episode of Clinical Conversations. If you haven't before, I encourage you all to check out ASHP's Ambulatory Care Resources. You can find member exclusive offerings such as the Ambulatory Care Career Tool, certification resources, rotation guides, guidelines, policies, and info on billing and reimbursement. Be sure also to become a member of the section of Ambulatory Care Practitioners Connect community, where you can exchange ideas and ask questions from your peers. Thanks again for tuning in for this episode, and be sure to subscribe to the ASHP podcast through your favorite podcast provider.
Thank you for listening to ASHP Official, the voice of pharmacists advancing healthcare. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time on ASHP Official.